Yes, I can.
We can hear you.
Yay.
Ms. Chairman.
Thank you, Your Honour. Now I'd like to ask you some questions about the new proviso to policy 12D that you seek, and that's the one that, that says for all discharges the measure demonstrably exceeds the benefits already required by Chapter 311.
Yes, Ms. Chairman, I can hear you, Rua, I can't see you.
Maybe the screen needs to be switched over.
The camera been. You got that? Thank you.
Thank you, I appreciate that. It's always much easier.
It is easier, indeed.
Yeah. I can see.
Otherwise, it seems like an unfair advantage, doesn't it? So, yes, in relation to that provision, you're familiar with the one that I'm talking about?
I am.
And to understand this a little better, is this provision attempting to reflect that NPSFM principle of additionality?
It is seeking to reflect the best practice offsetting principle of additionality, yes.
And that principle comes from Appendix 6 of the NPSFM?
Yes, it's also reflected in the VBOT principles and other documents that reflect best practice offsetting implementation.
And so that appendix is also referred to in what we call it, clause 3.24 of the NPSFM for River, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And so if that clause doesn't apply, then there is no need in relation to replacement discharges for it to be inserted into policy 12B, is there?
There's no statutory requirement to insert that, no.
Thank you. So turning, we're still in policy 12C, but I just want to address this issue of the inclusion of the word include instead of are into the list in policy 12C. And in the JWS, you didn't raise any issues with that list being a closed list, did you?
Not sure. I'll have to take a look at that. No, it looks like I didn't repeat my evidence in that JWS.
So was it because that wasn't important enough for you to raise it?
It wasn't actually, I don't recall it being a specific thing that was discussed. Amongst all the other things we discussed, it obviously didn't get attention on that day.
So it's listed, isn't it, under question 3 in relation to Mr. Trebilco's rebuttal evidence version?
It is, yeah.
Okay. And would you accept that a closed list provides some certainty for an applicant so that they know whether or not they should be proposing offsetting or compensation measures in policy 12B?
Yes, I agree that a closed list gives more certainty. I think in this case, a closed list would be this. If the list is closed, it should include more things than are in 1 to 3, because 1 to 3 don't reflect all of the matters that you should be considering when considering what a residual adverse effect is.
But in terms of considering a residual adverse effect that relates to the achievement of the target attribute states, it's load that is the key consideration, isn't it?
I understand it for point source discharges, the most relevant condition that you would have on a consent relating to achievement of the target attribute states would be a condition about load. However, residual adverse effects can relate to localised or specific effects that aren't related to load.
Is this another situation where you've got a distinction between replacement consents and new consents?
I don't think so, no. I think it's a situation where a discharge, well, in the case of an existing discharge, where a discharge is making improvements that are proportionate to their contribution, when that is aggregated at the monitoring site at the bottom of the catchment, there may be localised adverse effects depending on where the discharge point is, and it would be wrong to say that residual adverse effects only relate to load, because residual adverse effects may also relate to those more localised effects as well.
And so what sort of effects are you talking about in terms of those more localised effects?
So, if it, for example, if the discharge is into a small stream, the fecal coliforms, for example, may make that small stream or unsuitable for gathering mahingakai, but at the in the main stem at the monitoring point, it may be fine once it's diluted by other incoming streams, for example.
So those are issues, though, that are broader than what Policy 12 is considering, isn't it? Aren't they?
Well, Policy 12, in my reading, is how the least practical option, where after doing that, there are residual adverse effects, you may consider offsetting and compensation. When you're thinking about what is in a residual adverse effect, consider these matters. So, I don't think there's anything in there that says to me we're only considering cumulative adverse effects when there may be specific residual adverse effects at the local scale. They are still effects and should be considered.
And are those effects that are related to the achievement of the target attribute states in Table 3.11.1 in your view?
They are related to achieving the health and wellbeing of the water bodies throughout their entire length.
So different from those target attribute states in 3.11.1?
Yes, Objective 1 refers to both health and wellbeing generally and target attribute states specifically.
Are you aware of any other NPSs that apply the effects management hierarchy?
The NPS for Indigenous Biodiversity does.
Yes, and are you aware that there's an exclusion in that NPS that says that no part of that NPS applies to renewable electricity generation?
I actually haven't been into the NPS IB in preparation for this hearing, so.
But you'd accept that that could be the case, and that
yep.
if it is, that the effects management hierarchy is not always an across the board application, is it?
No, it's not.
Thank you. Nothing further, Your Honour.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. Mr. Muldoon?
Yes, sir, just one point of clarification. Good afternoon, Ms. Mark. Can you see me and hear me?
I can hear you, but I can't see you yet.
Hopefully that is resolved shortly. But it's
yes, I can see you now.
You're good. Oh, that's great. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's just a point of clarification. Are you aware that I think it was Monday afternoon, Ms. Only Council for Fish and Game circulated an updated set of amended provisions that was sought on behalf of Fish and Game? Were you aware of that circulation?
Yes.
Yeah. And that same document was handed around and up in court this morning. Are you familiar with that document, and did you participate in its preparation?
Yes, I did, and I'm familiar with it.
And I just want to confirm that the amendments that are set out, I think in blue in that document, represent the updated set of planning recommendations that you are proffering to this court today.
I believe so, yes.
Thank you. So there's certainly no trick to it, I just wanted to confirm.
Yeah.
Just as a housekeeping point, I'm not quite sure how that document might reach the record. Could I produce it through this witness if she's confirmed that she had a hand in?
Oh, well, I had received it on the basis that it formed part of counsel's submissions, mm-hmm. Which we don't normally ascribe an exhibit note to. If you're worried about us losing sight of it, I don't know if there's any particular problem. It could be made Exhibit 8, I suppose, for that purpose. It's not
actually evidence, no. Well, only in the sense that I wanted this witness to confirm that this is her set of recommendations, and she's done that.
Yes, well, you got it in the record in that way.
Yes.
And as I say, we've got it here as a document proffered by counsel as part of the relief her client seeks. So
yes, that's fine, sir. I'm satisfied.
Very good. Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Mark.
Mr. Malone?
No questions, Your Honour.
Thank you. Ms. Garden?
No questions, Your Honour.
Mr. Minton, no questions. Thank you. Ms. Olman, your witness. You don't get to cross it. There we are. Just reminding myself, Ms. Tumor.
No questions.
Thank you. Is anyone else present? Any re-examination?
No, thank you, Your Honour.
Any questions? No, I don't think I have any questions either. Thank you very much for your evidence, Ms. Mark. You're excused.
Thank you.
I just wanted to, prior to closing, pushing down this case, just raise one issue that I know neglected in the opening, which doesn't relate really to the evidence that Ms. Maher's given.
Just hang on a second, we're just shifting the microphone.
Thank you. I wish to reiterate that a key concern for Fish and Game is that this issue of nutrient trading, which we're going to deal with again at the main hearing, but it was Fish and Game's understanding that policy 12B2, which states the measure relates to the contaminant giving rise to the residual adverse effect, would cover that. Mr. Hamilton had a slightly different view, and as in Mr. Clay's evidence, Fish and Game deals with consent applications where phosphorus is stated to be the key contaminant in one case and then nitrogen stated to be the key contaminant in the other. So I just wanted to reiterate that is a very real concern for Fish and Game before closing the case.
Well, thank you for highlighting that. I mean, it does seem to me that the policy indicates that the measure taken under that part of policy 12B, needs to relate to the contaminant giving rise to the effect, so that there needs to be that direct correspondence. Mm. I think that it appears to me to be possible that in the context of an application and a discretionary consideration, an applicant might well put forward a case based on some kind of trade-off. And then it will be a matter for the consent authority and for any submitters who may be involved to say that's not an appropriate thing to do in all of these circumstances. I mean, there's more to it than 12B2, isn't there? Because there are the other provisions about trying to make sure that we focus on the four contaminants as they stand, and we do that in the context of the objectives.
Yes, there is. And I think the way it's played out, Fish and Game feels that 12B2 would give strong policy direction, and that would be most helpful to them, given past experiences.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Mark.
Thank you, sir. where my submissions on point source discharges was covered in my legal submissions.
Can I go back to those?
Yes, I thought it might be useful just to update those submissions in line with the memorandum that I filed today. So with regards to paragraph 121, that is no longer a concern or issue for the director general based on Ms. Kissick's views, and that initially the view was that this policy applied to discharge as well as point source discharge, but it's been clarified through discussions that that's not the case. So the reference to policy 5 is no longer applicable there. So that's the update there in respect to paragraph 121. With regards to 122, and that refers to policy 12A, the wording that I've referred to in 4A of my memorandum supersedes or updates the position in 122. So it's the wording that Ms. Kissick supports through the JWS is now the position that the Director General accepts and supports. And then with paragraph 123, well, that's all in relation to policy 12B1 and the reference to section 1072. I don't intend to traverse that any further, Sue. That's been well covered. I just draw the court's attention to 126, and that is Ms. Kissick's concern there. And I will ask her if that continues to be her concern given the evidence presented in this hearing. And then with regards to paragraph 128, again, referring back to my memo at paragraph 4C, that is the wording that Ms. Kissick supports and is the wording the Director General also supports. And then with regards to policy 13, Ms. Kissick supports that policy, including the reference to offsetting and compensation, provided that the reference to policy 12 remains in policy 13 as per the agreement in the JWS. With regards to objective 3, the Director General supports the position of council. We did not have an appeal point on objective 3.
Provided a regional council.
That's right, yeah. And nor did we have an appeal point on policy 11. Unless there are any questions, sir, I'll just move straight ahead to Paul Ms. Kissick.
Ms. Kissick, yes, is she on the line?
Yes, she is earlier.
Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Ms. Kissick, can you see me?
I can.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Your full name is Deborah Helen Kissick?
That's correct.
And you hold the qualification of a Bachelor of Science, majoring in Geography but specialising in Environmental Science.
That's right.
And you prepared evidence dated the 28th of July 2023?
Yep.
And you also participated in expert conferencing on point source discharges on the 18th of September this year?
Yes.
And so with regards to your evidence, do you have any corrections?
Yeah, I do have a couple of corrections I'd like to make. The first of those is at paragraph 247 of my evidence.
Sorry to interrupt, sir, but this hasn't been sworn in yet.
Oh, here we go. We're getting way ahead of ourselves. I apologise, it's to my responsibility. Ms. Kissick, just to start off, I ask whether you solemnly and sincerely declare and affirm that the evidence you will give at this hearing will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Sorry, you were going through some corrections at paragraph 247?
Thank you. Yes, so just at paragraph 247, as you've already alluded to, Mr. Tumai, I have referenced a link to between policy 5 and policy 12, and I have referred to policy 5 as providing general guidance on this matter. And I have inadvertently overlooked the subheadings in Plain Change 1, which identify when a policy relates to diffuse discharges or pointless discharges or both. And I just wanted to essentially correct this paragraph. Basically, if I can just delete that whole paragraph, that will clarify my position on that particular thing. So just essentially removing the linkage to policy 5 being an overarching policy on offsetting and compensation. So if we can delete that whole paragraph. And there is, did I miss something?
No, I was just saying thank you.
Thank you. And just one other correction on 274. So it's a similar matter, but if we could just delete in paragraph 74 at the top of page 60 of the evidence, if we could just delete the words, as the guiding policy on offsetting and compensation into, and just add in. So that sentence will read, it is efficient to include reference to policy 5 in policy 12.
Do you have any other corrections, Ms. Kizzet?
That's all. Is that clear?
Yes.
What is that? Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And so with those corrections, do you confirm your evidence to be true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes, just with the exception of the positions that I reached with other experts in the journalism statement.
Yes. And so we might just go there before you answer any questions. So, but before we go to the witness statement agreements that you reached, I just wanted to refer you to paragraph 7 of your evidence.
Sure.
And that refers to having involvement in a range of planning matters, including preparation of submissions on national, regional and district planning processes. Do you want to talk to that paragraph, please?
Yes, sure. Thank you. So I just thought I'd clarify for the benefit of the court that Tauhara District Council is a client of my firm, Traverse Environmental, and that we work alongside Tauhara District Council on projects, largely in an iwi relationship capacity, but also in providing planning advice. And I have been involved personally in the reconsenting of discharges from the Mangapino and Tauhara wastewater treatment plants, and that work has been during the time that Plan Change 1 has been proposed. So for the Mangapino project in late 2019, I was involved in preparing an updated resource consent application, including reference to the notification of Plan Change 1 in that application. And I also prepared a guidance memo in relation to offsetting for the application and recommending offsetting actions be considered as a result of Plan Change 1, but noting the status of the plan change at that time. And then in relation to the Rakanui Road discharge from the Tauhara wastewater treatment plant, I prepared an addendum application in April 2021 to the original application, which was lodged in 2015. And the addendum was to update the application specifically in relation to the MPCFM in 2020 and Plan Change 1 and in relation to statutory acknowledgements that had progressed since the original application was lodged. And I guess I'm just providing that context as part of my involvement there was essentially a lull in proceedings from Plan Change 1 at the time that I undertook that work. And but essentially my advice has been consistent throughout, so I just wanted to provide that context. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms Kissick. And for the court, so, it was more also around declaring any perceived or actual conflicts. That's the point of that question, sir.
I see. But as counsel, you don't perceive any conflicts arising out of that, do you?
No, sir. No. I've looked at that closely. No, sir. So, Ms Kissick, I just wanted to ask a couple of questions in relation to the agreement you reached in the joint witness statement for point source discharges.
Correct.
And so with the first one is in relation to policy 12A.
Yes.
On the, it's 401.0173 in terms of the reference, and in that table on that page, in the first row, there's some wording agreed in relation to 12A by those planners identified there. And then there's also, if you go further down the table to where the wording you've agreed with on policy 12A. Now, you have been listening to the hearing yesterday and today. And so you will would have heard the questions around there being three stages to in terms of the merits of any mixing to the going through the BPO to the mixing itself. So do you have any thoughts in light of those conversations, and given the wording that you've agreed to, I guess my question to you is, do you still have that, do you still agree with that wording in light of conversations and evidence presented in this hearing?
Yes, I do. And I've set out in my evidence as well that I consider that the best practical option takes account of the receiving environment and the any effects on that receiving environment, and I consider that that includes any reasonable mixing. So it's part of that receiving environment. So I would say that the policy wording in 12A that I have agreed to in the joint witness statement, I think, provides clarity that it's part of that consideration of the BPO.
Thank you.
Consider someone else in here. Thank you.
And the other question is in relation to policy 12B1 and the reference in that policy to section 107.2 of the RMA. Again, you've heard the evidence presented so far and the views and the concerns of it being deleted or included. Has your view changed in relation to that wording?
No. I think, if anything, I'm more confused than I perhaps was to begin with. In the role that this policy itself takes in terms of considering when offsetting and compensation is appropriate. I maintain that it's my view that any offsetting and compensation needs to be considered, but not on effect that might be significant to aquatic life or toxic. So my view remains the same, that I don't support the inclusion of section 107.2 in this particular policy.
Thank you, Ms Kissick. Please answer any questions.
Thank you.
You were online when I put a number of questions to Ms Mark earlier today.
Yes, I was. Sorry, Ms Chap, I can't see you, but I can hear you, so feel free to carry on.
It's a common problem, we'll fix it.
Yeah. There we go, thank you.
So you heard those questions that I put to Ms Mark.
I did.
Rather than go through all of those questions all over again, perhaps I can put it to you a different way. And that is to really ask the question as to whether or not you have any difference of opinion with respect to the answers that Ms. Mark gave with respect to specific issues. So I'm not going to touch on Policy 11 because I don't understand that to be part of your evidence. But in terms of the reference to exceptional circumstances in Policy 12B1, do you have any difference of opinion with respect to the matters expressed by Ms. Mark?
I can't recall what she said word for word, but no, generally I am of a similar opinion to Ms. Mark in that respect.
Thank you. In relation to Policy 12C, which is whether or not it should be a closed or an open list, is that a matter that you touch on in your evidence?
No, it's not.
And so you don't have a view as to which that should be?
It's not within the brief I've been asked to discuss, so I don't have a particular view.
Thank you. And with respect to the application of the NPSFM to the point source discharge policies, does your view differ?
No.
Thank you. And that's the same with respect to what I've referred to as the additionality provision. Is that a matter that your evidence traverses as well?
It does, yes.
It does. And you don't have a difference of opinion with respect to Ms. Kissick in that regard?
With Ms. Maher, no.
Sorry, Ms. Maher. My apologies.
No problem.
So no difference of opinion?
No difference.
Thank you. I don't have anything further for this witness then. Thank you, Ms. Kissick.
Thank you.
Mr. Muldoon. No, thank you, sir. No, thank you, Mr. Muldoon. Go ahead.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Mr.
Minton.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Kissick.
Hello. Just get the microphone. Yes.
Thank you. I understand your briefing from the Department of Conservation has been primarily around the relief that's sought in the Director General's Notice of Appeal.
Yes.
And you may have heard me deliver legal submissions for Fish and Game before lunch.
I did. Yeah.
And so you would have heard me state that in Fish and Game's Notice of Appeal, Fish and Game sought a definition for offset and compensate.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that the additionality point be included in the policy?
Yes.
Policy 12, that is.
Yes.
So is it your understanding that there's an obligation to give effect to the National Policy Statement Freshwater Management insofar as it's within the scope of appeals?
That's my understanding, yes.
And so have you, the phrase shoehorning has been used in relation to placing certain matters of the NPSFM within Policy 12 at this point in time.
Yes.
Have you turned your mind into whether using the definitions of aquatic compensation and aquatic offset in the NPSFM instead of the definitions sought in Fish and Game's Notice of Appeal are very similar, would create a shoehorning or any other problem? Have you looked
at those? I haven't looked at those definitions in detail, but the Fish and Game Appeals sought to include definitions of those terms, and those terms are, the relief was similar to what is now in the NPSFM. I would consider that is appropriate for those definitions to be included in Plan Change 1 now to provide clarity.
And Dr. Corkery's evidence talks about the importance of the effects management hierarchy that sets offset prior to compensation, and
yes.
I'll provide you with the relevant reference. It's her evidence in chief at paragraph 48, where she says the proposed PC1 does not clearly differentiate between these two. The recommended amendments by WRC do not contain a definition for either of these terms, so they were both now clearly defined in the NPSFM. Both the quantum offsetting and compensation are often referred to in tandem in PC1, suggesting there is a choice between both, when in fact there is a clear hierarchy under the NPSFM. And then she goes on to say that compensation should only be attempted after offsetting has been demonstrated not to be possible.
Yes.
So you'll be familiar with that evidence.
Yes, indeed.
So the definition in the NPSFM of a quotient offset contains reference to that hierarchy, doesn't it? Because it talks about measures being sequentially applied in terms of avoidance, minimisation and remediation.
That's right, yes.
And do you consider that that would be useful?
I do, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any re-examination?
No, sir.
I have no questions either. Thank you very much for your evidence, Ms. Kizik. You're excused.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. That concludes the Director General's case.
Thank you. Now, I'm not sure whether Mr. Ferguson, we haven't heard any further from Mr. Ferguson, have we? Is any Mr. Conway?
Your Honour, I understand Mr. Ferguson can't be here today.
Yes.
To a High Court.
Indeed, that's what I hope.
Mr. Brupp is here.
Yes.
And I think the arrangement Mr. Ferguson was hoping would be that Mr. Brupp could be called and questioned without Mr. Ferguson present.
Right.
Now, whether that's done with someone else leading him through the preliminaries or...
Well, I can lead him, if this is any objection, I can lead him through. Both Dr. Asail and Mr. Brough were listed as being available if required. Is it only Mr. Brough? Is it your understanding?
I understand that's the case. Mr. Ferguson emailed counsel to ask whether anyone had any questions for Dr. Asail, and no one did,
no
as
one
far
did.
As I'm aware, but they may be able to confirm that, but I don't think Dr. Asail...
Well, we have yet to hear the main case, and I think Dr. Asail is giving evidence in the main part of the case as well.
Yes, that's right.
All right, is Mr. Brough there on the line? Oh, you're here.
Solemnly, sincerely, and truthfully declare and affirm that the evidence you are about to give to this court shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Yes. Mr. Brough, it's slightly unusual for a witness to be called in a case in a New Zealand court without counsel there to lead that witness. I'm happy to, and I don't have it up in front of me, but let me just give me a moment. As long as you are comfortable that you give, where are we? Here we are. This evidence, and if at any stage you're concerned about something you've been asked or evidence that you may wish to give, you signal that to me, and I can not necessarily act in place of counsel because that wouldn't be appropriate, but I can just make sure that the evidential process is kept within the boundaries that we normally have for the evidential process. All right?
Thank you, sir.
I doubt in a hearing like this that there's going to be any particular problem, but you never know with lawyers. Now, I'm just making sure if there's... And there is. So what I have in front of me, just about in front of me, a statement of evidence you've prepared dated the 28th of July 2023.
That's correct.
And there's a rebuttal statement. It will be dated sometime around the middle of August 2023, but it won't come up on screen. Thank you very much. So you've also prepared a rebuttal statement dated 11 August?
That's correct.
Are those statements of evidence true and correct? Well, sorry, I'll start again. Do you need to make any corrections or edits to those, either of those statements?
No, I don't. Safe to say that we have agreed to meet as the joint witness statement, they supersede my evidence.
All right, well, I was going to get to the joint witness statement in a second, but let's just confirm your evidence. You confirm that those statements of evidence, as they stand, are true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief.
I do.
And then there is the joint witness statement for point source discharges, which is what we're focused on here. You were a participant in that process?
I was.
And you've seen the record of that, which includes your signature at the end of it?
I have.
And it accurately sets out your position in that expert witness conference?
It does.
Thank you very much. I don't think there's anything else that I need to cover. Is there anything that you feel you should address before I see whether there are any questions for you?
No, I don't think so.
Thank you very much. Right, Mr. Conway, any questions?
No, thank you, sir.
Ms. Chappell?
I will endeavour not to create any evidential problems for this witness, sir.
All from me.
Mr. Brock, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Perhaps relieved to hear that I'm planning on being very brief with my questions. Really, the question that I want to ask you is with respect to Objective 3, which I understand you to oppose the amendments that are proposed by Dr. Mitchell in that regard to Objective 3. Is that correct?
I support the Council vision, that's correct.
You'll be familiar with the Waikato Tainui Raupatu Claims Waikato River Settlement Act 2010 in a general sense?
In a general sense, yes.
And so Section 9 of that Act is about recognising the vision and the strategy for Waikato River?
Sorry to refine me, but if you say so.
And the first subsection of that is that the Waikato River and its contribution to New Zealand's cultural, social, environmental and economic well-being are of national importance. You accept that that's what that says without having it in front of you?
Yes.
Thank you. Would you agree then that there is a broader reference in that piece of legislation to people and communities more generally than just the Waikato and Waipa communities?
Yes, there is. But also think there is a particular focus on the communities within the Waikato and Waipa River.
In terms of Te Ture Whanau. In terms of Te Ture Whanau, I'm just going to repeat that for the transcript.
Sorry.
And I'll keep my answer, yes, that's correct. In terms of Te Ture Whanau.
Thank you, Mr. Brook. Would you have any objection to amending that clause so that it, that objective so that it referred to people and communities?
On the face of it, no. But having been around when the Clever Stakeholder Group postulated for a long time about the cost to the communities at large for giving effect to Te Tiriti Whamana in the scheme of Plan Change 1, or the Healthy Rivers Wildlife Plan Change, as it was called back then. They came up with a view they had two objectives, objective 2 and 4, I believe they were. One was a short-term faced objective, one was longer-term, and they tried to grapple with that issue of how do you, not offset cost, but how do you ease the burden of cost on those communities? And they reached that conclusion that the best way they could possibly do that was to stage those reductions over time, which is well established now. But in my view, it may not be for the best if we were to change Objective 3 to people and communities at large, because we lose sight of the cost that will be borne on the communities of the Waikato Waipa River. And I think that is probably a nuance that's best left in Plan Change 1, particularly as it becomes operative and merges with the regional plan, where there are other objectives that do talk about that enablement of people and communities.
So you see this as being a much more narrow objective then, compared to some of the other objectives in the plan and particularly the regional policy statement that focus more on enabling, for example, regionally significant industry?
Yes, that would be my view. Look, I think it is appropriate for this particular plan change because it's a city fund. I did some work last night quickly to look at other regional plans to see if I could find any other distinction that was more narrowed, and I couldn't, and it's all a general enablement. And I understand that, and I accept the evidence that Dr. Mitchell proposed in that respect, and also, the wider definition of people that you discussed yesterday, and I accept that, but I still believe that nuance is important in this context.
You were present when I put to Mr. Trebilco the document which is titled The Outcome Statement and Principles for Implementing Te Reo Whai Mana.
I was.
And did you wish to make any comment in relation to that provision that was drafted in that table where it refers to the importance of placing a flexible approach that enables communities' well-being to be met, including maintaining and enhancing economic well-being, the restoration and protection of the Waikato and Waipa rivers?
I don't believe I do, except to say that I thought that at the time it was a reasonably well-crafted document which gave some direction to the member stakeholder group. But in my reading of that document, and I could be wrong, I haven't got it in front of me in particular at the moment, but my understanding was that the River Iwi were concerned that the communities of the Waikato Mapa River catchment should be enabled, but that enablement should be within limits. I think that's in that particular document. I can take you there if you like.
What you're talking about is that reference and objective 3 to the staging aspect of the plan.
Yes, and also the fact that an objective is an anticipated future state. I think that's an important thing, and it's really hard to enable something while it's happening, if that makes sense. So if you were looking at a limits construct, you should enable if everyone's sitting within limits, because it makes sense in that way. But if the resource is over-allocated, then perhaps you need to manage it more closely so you do achieve those limits before you have that full enablement. And it's a very tricky construct to work through an objective.
There was another objective, wasn't there, in the pre-decisions version that was combined with this objective, wasn't there? Do you recall that?
Yes, that's my understanding. I think it was objective 2, objective 4, yes. And the hearings panel decided not to go with the section 42A recommendation to delete objective 2, and they went with objective 4 and merged that.
Yes.
I think that was how it went.
Yes, so they were combining a number of considerations into the one objective.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. I've got no further questions.
Mr. Muldoon. No, thank you, sir. Mr. Malone.
No, Your Honour.
Ms. Garvin.
No, thank you, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Minton.
No, thank you, sir.
Ms. Romney.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr.
Farrell. Good afternoon.
I noticed that some of the objectives on the Tupuru Whai Mana. I noticed that some of the objectives in Te Tiru Whai Mana do relate to economic issues, such as B, C and D, relationships with the river include economic, social, cultural and spiritual relationships. The river holds strategic importance to New Zealand's social, cultural, environmental and economic well-being. And economic well-being requires the restoration and protection of the health and well-being of the Waikato River. Can you comment on that concept as it relates to the concept of Te Mana o Te Wai in the National Policy Statement, freshwater management, which creates a hierarchy, as you know, but does also deal with well-being, people's well-being, albeit after the needs of the Wai. Do you see any inconsistency with the Te Tiru Whai Mana, which talks about economic as well as other well-beings, and Te Mana o Te Wai?
I don't believe there's a direct inconsistency. I do believe you have to read Te Tiri Whamanga on its whole, and it doesn't pay to forensically pick in between. And to be fair, I'm guilty of doing that in my evidence, but as a general rule, you really should look at it on its whole. Whereas Tamano Te Wai, in my understanding, and to be fair, there's probably more of a question that needs to be put to Tangata Whenua in terms of their aspirations for Tamano Te Wai and their understanding and their views and value constructs and how that works for them. And in this particular case, that's also overlaying with the Kingitanga principle of Tamano Te Awa. So it's very nuanced in this catchment, and it's a question I don't think that the iwi have grappled with entirely. So I'd be loath to talk on their behalf. But to answer your question, Zongi, I don't think there's a direct inconsistency, but I do think in terms of the process to determine the view for Tangata Whenua, there may well be some areas that nested over time may be slightly different.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
No questions, thank you.
Just a couple of questions for you. You've been here in the last couple of days?
I have.
So you would have heard some of the questions I've been putting around point source discharge and the involvement of Māori in this aspect of things, correct?
Correct.
Did you have a view about what some of the questions I've been putting to some of these witnesses? Certainly around the involvement of some of the female.
I do. And for me, I've been involved with the Waka Tangata River iwi since 2012 in this particular capacity. And since that time, I've seen an evolving suite of practice as it pertains to applicants engaging with the river iwi and kind of the Whenua at large. And I think you've seen that today's evidence, and I suspect the things that happened in the most recent past, in other words, 12, 14 months ago, may not have happened when I first started in 2012. So my view are things are evolving, and I think that's a function of the settlement legislation.
Mm.
That's also a function of joint management agreements that exist between the River Iwi individually and the local authorities and the regional council. And a clever applicant will know the legislation and understand the joint management agreements, and they will seek out the engagement of the River Iwi or Tangata Whenua at the early stage of application.
Mm.
The ones perhaps that don't do that are normally advised by the council in a pre-hearing meeting that they should go and talk to Tangata Whenua, and that, in my experience, generally does happen. So I would say firstly that it's an evolving suite of practice. The extent to which Tangata Whenua and River Iwi are involved in decision-making on those particular applications in respect of their construction, so with the applicant and how the application itself is framed, I think it's variable. I myself have been involved.
As a practice, you mean it's variable?
Yes, it's variable across, yes. I've been involved personally with an application working on behalf of Waka Te Whānui. We were engaged quite directly at the front end of the application, and that was very fruitful in terms of the things that we could work with the applicant to. I won't use the word manufacture, but at least highlight in the application. But in terms of the questions you've asked directly, I'm unaware of any situation where Tangata Whenua have been involved in a decision-making capacity on, say, a regional mixing zone,
mm.
or what the best practical option might be. But that's to say, not to say that it hasn't happened, it's just that I'm not aware of it.
Mm. And you would have, you've seen the Waikato regional plan, haven't you? So I note that this is document 501-0537. I note that there's a reference in the plan under the heading under the objective component, which talks about the management of water bodies. Have you seen that?
Can you direct me to it?
Yeah. So it's page 501-0608 of the regional plan.
Is on the electronic version?
Yes, on the electronic version. Sorry.
I have to wake it up.
0608.
0608. what was that reference again, sir?
It's page 501, 0608.
I have that page.
Okay, so you've got the heading objective.
Yes.
It talks about the management of water bodies in a way that can ensure this, right? And if you head down to I, it talks about the significant effects on the relationship under the whenua and kaitiaki have with water and their identified taonga, such as wāhi, native flora and fauna, that if customary and traditional uses in or on the margins of water bodies are remedied or mitigated, correct?
Correct.
And also, Jay talks about the cumulative effects on the relationship they have as kaitiaki with their water. Now, can I just ask you to scroll down now to page 501-0610, the top of that page. It starts with the modi. Yeah? So these next two paragraphs explain what is provided for in the ones I've just read out to you. And they say the modi of water resources is dependent on the physical and spiritual health of the water. Contamination or degradation of water has the effect of diminishing its modi. Tangata whenua who take an active role as kaitiaki involved in the spiritual and physical aspects of their local natural resources, and as such, are best placed to identify taonga and customary resources of those resources. So from that, it would seem to indicate to me that they should be involved in the decision making because they are best placed to identify them. Would you accept that?
I would.
Okay. That's all I wanted to say. Kia ora.
Kia ora.
And I have no questions. Thank you very much for your evidence, Mr. Brown. I think that's all that we have scheduled for this part of the hearing in relation to point source discharge. Does anyone have anything else that they consider we should be addressing at this stage? No? Very good. So we look forward now to the 6th of November and going into week 4. And we've got fish and game at the beginning of that week. Then Horticulture New Zealand, Pukeko Vegetable Growers, and then the Waikato and Waipa River Iwi, CNI Land, Iwi Land Management Limited, Iwi of Hauraki. It appears to us at this stage that the hearing is likely to conclude at some stage in week 4. Does anybody else have any better estimate of time? I know that some of you who are here at the moment won't be involved at all, I suspect, in relation to that. Mr. Conway, in terms of your planning, what do you think?
That's my expectation too, sir. That would be my hope.
Okay. Ms. Longley, you think so?
I know there are a lot of witnesses to get through with Horticulture New Zealand and Pukekohe, but I don't expect that I will take much time with them.
No, well, a number of them are the growers, and that evidence is very valuable, but as perhaps with the dairy farmers and sheep and beef farmers, cross-examination of them for the purposes of a plan change is probably not going to advance the issues in terms of Section 32 terribly far. No, well, that's fine. Good. Well, we may, we won't necessarily deal with it straight away, but we will probably indicate to the venue that we won't probably need time in the week of 13 November. Now, we had spoken on a preliminary basis, and again, I acknowledge that not everybody who's going to be involved in this is here right now, but just to confirm that we would be looking at any party who wished to file submissions in closing, as it were, to be able to present those prior to the week before December. And then we would look at an opportunity in the week before December in this courtroom as an opportunity for mainly for us to ask any questions that we may may have, in which case we try to give notice ahead of time of what we thought we might be asking about. Just so you know, and I can't recall whether or not I indicated a date for that, but we probably wouldn't be doing it on the Friday of that week. The registrar will be back in contact with everyone to find out what availability is like in relation to that. Does anybody have any question or comment about that likely schedule?
We're in the process of engaging with the parties to ascertain which date.
Very good.
Preference, so we will be in touch through.
If you would manage that, that would be good. As I say, please try and avoid the Friday.
Yes, I think it's already been ruled out, sir.
Here we are. I'm glad to see that everyone is thinking along the same line. Anyone else have anything
to
add?
Can I just clarify, is that just one day, sir?
Well, that's what we're thinking at this stage, because if closings or any notes that people want to raise or any further revised versions of provisions that anybody wants to file, we'd certainly like those in advance. And then the purpose of this would not necessarily be to have any further hearing. We should have completed the evidence at that stage. And we doubt that we need presentations of submissions, but we do think that, as was suggested, the opportunity for us perhaps to ask questions of the council for parties would be quite valuable.
I see. Thank you.
The main set of revised provisions, I think, we'd be expecting from the Regional Council. In terms of where we are at the moment, and I appreciate that this can only be on a preliminary basis because you don't know what fireworks are likely to occur in week four, but how soon do you think you might be able to provide the up-to-date version of the Regional Council's provision? The Regional Council's up-to-date version of its
provision. Yes, Your Honour, so if we recommence and we set all of the week of the 6th to 10th of November, I would be looking to work pretty intently in the following week to make any updates, if we could file them before the end of that week.
Well, if it was before the end of that week, and if the day that we're talking about is not necessarily the Monday, not ruling that out, but we can look at those, the document as it comes in. And yes, that should be...
Yes, if it was say 17th, and then that would leave 2 weeks between then and resuming. So our...
should be ample.
Yes, and there's a possibility if we'd assist the court, it would certainly assist us. If other parties wanted to close on the basis of our interim set of provisions, and then we could make any further updates if necessary and file that without closing.
Well, it's just various things have been on the move as we go, and
yeah,
that may well be the same thing the week after next. So it does seem to us as though the convergence that I think has been happening for some time, there may well be a little bit of more convergence, and we'd rather take advantage of that with the time it's available than close people off too soon. But hey, in fact, the way the timetable is set out, you probably can have a dialogue with any of those parties who remain with significant or moderately significant issues about the current form of the wording and see whether or not there is any movement like to.
Yes, understood, sir.
So just to be clear, you were expecting that you could provide this text by 17 November.
Yes, that's the date I've got in mind.
Then it's the 4th of December, so it's actually 2 weeks after that
that's fine.
That we'd be reconvened. Yeah. Now, during that two-week period, and again, we won't set the date at this stage, but that would be the period in which we'd want parties' closings to be able to be provided.
Yeah, the reason I was just checking that is that I'm in another hearing on plan change too, and I know that Tom will be involved in that, so I just want to make sure that there's no impact on that.
And of course, you know, a go-ahead council like the Manawatu Whanganui Regional Council, they may well have it all sorted out.
I don't think
so, Joe. Well, you could have let us down a bit more gently. Judge Temple will be unsurprised by that question.
Yes.
No. Thank you all very much for your participation in this. That has been conducted in a very direct and efficient way. We're grateful for that. So we'll adjourn now and, as I say, reconvene with some of you at least in Hamilton on the 6th of November. Thank you.